If you like Area 45, you're going to enjoy the Hoover Institution's other podcasts, Uncommon Knowledge, The Classicist with Victor Davis Hanson, and The Libertarian with Richard Epstein. Subscribe now to the Hoover Podcast at hoover.org/podcasts. That's hoover.org/podcasts. Hoover Podcast, ideas defining a free society. Hello, it's Monday, August the 5th, and welcome to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast examining the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States, and for this podcast, at least those who hope to face him next November. I'm Bill Whalen, the Virginia Hobbs Carpenter Research Fellow at the Hoover Institution. Our guest plural today here in our recording studio on the campus of Stanford University are David Brady and Doug Rivers. Dave Brady is the Davies Family Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution. He's also the Bowen H. and Janice Arthur McCoy Professor of Political Science at the Stanford Graduate School of Business. Doug Rivers is a Hoover Institution Senior Fellow and a Stanford University Political Scientist. He's also the Chief Scientist at YouGov PLC, a global polling firm, and he owns what I think is one of the truly great self-descriptions on Twitter, which is, quote, absent-minded professor, sometime entrepreneur, pollster, and econometrician, which causes half of America to go look up what is an econometrician. Guys, thanks for coming back on the podcast. So we have had two debates now, not one, but two Democratic debates. The first one drew 15.3 million viewers on NBC, MSNBC, Telemundo on its first night. Night two, it apexed at 18.1 million viewers. Second debate held in Detroit and aired only on CNN drew 8.7 million viewers the first night, 10.7 million viewers on Wednesday night. My math is maybe not as good as yours, but my rudimentary mathematical skills tell me that is a 40% drop-off in viewers from the previous debate. The next debate's not until September 12th through 13th in Houston. Quick question, gentlemen. Is it a good thing or a bad thing for the Democratic Party that fewer people were watching at this point?
Good thing. Given how the debates were structured,
it is a leading question.
We're not doing any help for the Democratic candidates.
Why not?
Well, the whole format is... too many candidates speaking too little,
Me cutting you off mid-answer every time, right?
Yes, and the moderators cutting off the candidates.
Yes.
I think the format is one designed to be optimal for the cable channels,
right?
But not for the Democratic candidates. Mm-hmm.
I think the way to think about that is what CNN and the channel want. They want viewers.
Right.
And so they kind of got what they wanted. That's a lot more viewers than CNN normally gets. But for me, I agree with Doug, it was a terrible format. I thought the worst part of it was they all sort of pushed themselves to be further left. And the first one, where they had the thing, raise your hand if you're for Medicare for All and ending private insurance.
So they did that in the first debate, but Democrats went to CNN the second debate and said, no,
they're not going to do it.
Not going to happen.
You are not allowed to make any more commercials for the Trump campaign.
Yeah. Correct.
So exactly. So the point is, it would be as though saying, if you want to lose the presidential election, raise your hand.
Exactly.
And so the way to think about that, why it's a terrible format for the Democrats, because he says too many. But if you're sitting there thinking, and you think to yourself, if I'm a Republican pollster or a Republican that makes commercials, this is great.
Exactly.
This is great because they're going to pay for this at the election time. So it's a terrible format. I'm a little worried about the next format that they're still not going to get they're still going to have 6, 7, 8, right?
No, they have. So the next debate, as mentioned, is in Houston, your old stomping grounds, Dave Brady. September 12th, 13th, the qualifications change. Up the ante. So you now have to have at least 2% in four different polls from June 28th to August 28th. I assume Economist YouGov might be a Democratic-sanctioned poll. Hope it is.
I don't know. I haven't watched.
You check this. Good question. No, the Democratic Committee will only, the National Committee will only recognize, will only sanction certain polls. So you just, you can't, show the Drudge Snap poll showing I have 5%. You have to be sanctioned by the DNC. You also have to have a minimum of 130,000 unique donors, at least 400 unique donors in 20 states. So you have
what is a unique donor? What's the minimum?
Individual donor.
But you can't give a dollar.
Yeah, yes, you can give a dollar.
Well, then they should be able to solve that problem easily.
No, it costs something on the order of $60 to $80 to generate a $1 contribution.
That
to
is true.
One of these second tier candidates.
Dave, you got to spend money to make money.
Okay,
it's the law of unintended consequences. So, right. The idea was that the Sanders campaign in 2016 and the Obama campaigns had these big grassroots followings, and that seemed like a good thing.
Right.
So they put in this requirement for many small donors, But of course, most of these candidates have no chance organically of getting that number of donations. Mm-hmm. So what they do is a couple things. One is to hire digital marketers to go out and raise the money for them. But the second thing it's done is converted into a national campaign. You can't get that many donors from Iowa or New Hampshire, but what you can do is get it from being on the cable news channels.
Right.
So it's turned out to be something that we're getting candidates who can appeal nationally to hardcore Democratic-based voters who are the only ones
that will make donations. But that's a key point because I think it pushes them further left.
Okay, so if the cutoff for qualifying for the Houston debate were tomorrow, eight Democrats right now qualify.
Yeah, that's what I said.
They are Joe Biden,
Cory
Booker, Pete Buttigieg, the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, Kamala Harris, California senator, Amy Klobuchar, senator from Minnesota, Beto O'Rourke, former congressman from Texas, El Paso, Bernie Sanders, and Elizabeth Warren. There are several Democrats on the bubble right now. Andrew Yang, Julian Castro, Tulsi Gabbard all have the fundraising numbers, but they don't have four polls that they can refer to. Tom Steyer has cracked 2% in two polls, but he doesn't have the numbers yet, which he has 8 million people, I think, on his Need to Impeach website. I think he should be able to find 130,000 donors pretty fast. So you're looking in a field of about a dozen or so people, down from 20. Doug, let's talk about, though, the field you were talking before we came started recording this. Who is now at the head of the pack? The pack is separated now. There's sort of there's a front runner and a front bunch and then a back bunch.
So Biden is the clear front runner in most of the polls. Mm-hmm. He's down from his peak levels, and people notice various cracks in his support, that it's a little weaker than the number suggests.
Was peak Joe when he announced, or did Joe peak after he announced?
After he announced.
Right after he announced.
Okay.
We have Elizabeth Warren as number two. Early on, Sanders was the number two candidate, and we show that he's dropped back so that he's approximately in fourth place.
Right.
It's close between Harris and Sanders, but right now we show Biden with, on the order of 5 points or so ahead of Warren, and then Warren a few points ahead of Harris and Sanders.
And how has this scrambled since they had their first debate in Miami at the end of June?
Well, Warren and Harris went up significantly, especially Harris.
She's fallen back down a little now.
She has, as Buttigieg had a surge and has weakened somewhat. So he's the fifth place candidate in our polls. Yeah.
Okay, and you mentioned a couple of Democrats who are still in the game, but I think the phrase you used was life support.
I would say, Cory Booker, Beto O'Rourke, Amy Klobuchar.
So they're still qualifying for debates, but they're not catching fire.
I think Beto is the clearest example. Ground. He's gone. He's gone nowhere.
I suspect he'll run for Senate in Texas.
You think he'll switch over and run against John Cornyn, and do you think Hick and Looper will do the same in Colorado?
I think both of those are probable.
I think they have a better chance there than they do.
Hick and Looper, there's already reporting to that extent.
There are already websites out there.
They registered some.
Right.
In the case, O'Rourke is not going anyplace in this campaign, so it's been a bit of an embarrassment to him. And the events over the weekend and Cornyn's response to them seemed to me like a great opportunity for Beto to pivot.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Very interesting. Dave, you wrote a column for Rear Clear Politics the other week in which you talked about the Democratic Party and its relationship with the electorate. The title of it was Biden is Still the King of Moderates, but Will It Last? And I'm going to read you a passage from it. I want to get your comment on this. You wrote, quote, in staking his case for the Democratic nomination on his electability, Biden bears the burden of proving that he is actually the general election winner he claims to be. While it is too early in the primary season to definitively answer that question, recent polling data contains some worrisome signs for the front runner. What is worrisome?
It's what Doug said. So here's a guy who, when he first came out, if you break it down, as we can on the YouGov Economist poll, you break it down. Mm-hmm. He was doing very well among moderates and independents, i.e. the group that he has to have, he's going to the center. But after the first debate, well, if you actually look at the time trend, he's falling among moderates and independents. Elizabeth Warren is among people who say they're independent. Now Elizabeth Warren is tied with him as the first, who they would vote for in a Democratic primary. And among moderates, he still leads. He's picked back up just a little bit, but the sign among moderates, but the that's the worrisome sign for him. Among the key block of voters, he's got to have if people are going to believe he's going
to win. Okay, Doug, I'm going to give you three theories as to why Biden may struggle, and I'll let you go down whichever rabbit hole you want to.
I'm good at multiple choice tests.
Very good. Okay, number one is obviously age. The man will be 77 years old in November. Democrats historically do not do age. Hillary Clinton turned 69 in the 2016 election. We saw what happened. If you go back all the way to FDR, the oldest Democrat to win office as a first-time candidate, meaning not Truman, not LBJ, didn't inherit the office and run for re-election, but first-time candidates. Jimmy Carter is the oldest winner. He was 52 years old in 1976. Okay. So they like 40-something, early 50-something Democrats. They don't like
Bill,
60s
that was
and
your father's Democrats.
Very much so. So theory number one is she's just a little too old, and by being that age, he doesn't fit the profile if we want somebody young who has a young family who's very well suited to talk about tomorrow. Theory number two, Doug, he's just not talking big ideas. He's not throwing out anything big and heavy and sexy like Medicare for All or free college tuition or cash reparations for slavery. And then theory number three, and I want to get both your takes on this one actually, is his anti-Trump message. You have Democrats who are making it very personal. Donald Trump, he's a crook. He's a felon. He should be impeached. You have Democrats running against him on policy, mainly health care. But Biden is category number three, and Joe Biden is basically running as a 77-year-old big bottle of Xanax, in that he is going to essentially get America over its mental health crisis right now. Run with that.
That gives me a little running room. So let's take them in order.
Okay.
Age.
Age.
So I believe Biden would be 78 if he wins the election.
When elected.
I want to interject here. You guys be very careful. I resemble these ages. So. I'm older than Biden, so let's be careful how you speak.
Okay.
I'll turn you into the ages.
Gotcha. Okay, but age 77.
Biden is Exhibit A for this argument.
But, yes. But at age 77, this is something different for the Democratic Party.
He's older than Trump. Though I would say he's not particularly older than his prime Democratic competition. Bernie Sanders is, I believe, a year younger than him.
If you ask what I do in my spare time, by the way, I wrote a piece for Forbes on this the other day. He is either older than half the field or he's either half the field is either was not alive when he was first going into the Senate in 1973, or in the case of Kamala Harris and Kirsten Gillibrand, they were in grade school. Cory Booker was a preschooler. So it is a huge gulf between him and a lot of that field.
Yeah, so before we were overtaken by events in the last week, I ran a poll asking people how old they thought the various candidates were.
Wow.
And And to be honest, I didn't know how old some of them were.
Mm-hmm.
And they did better than I expected. So the modal answer for Kamala Harris was 50 to 55, and I believe she's 54.
Right.
They overestimated the age of Pete Buttigieg, thinking that he was in his 40s.
He's 38, I think.
37, I believe.
Yeah, okay.
Joe Biden, Democrats systematically underestimated his age and thought he was younger than Trump, when in fact Republicans got that one right.
Mm-hmm.
So over half the Democrats think Biden is younger than Trump, and an overwhelming fraction of the country thinks he's in his 60s or early 70s, not north of 75. So there's some bad news for the Biden campaign because if he gets the nomination, they will know that by November of next year.
It's not necessarily. I mean,
well, in your case, Bernie, it may make you more likely to vote for him.
Well,
right?
The point is that if you combine that with the third one, he's the Xanax.
Right.
Yeah. If he's running against Trump, you might say that's great.
Mm-hmm. The one thing that stuck out here is that people subtract 10 years off Elizabeth Warren's age. She's 70 years old.
Right.
And most people think she's about 60.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I don't think age is a good thing for Biden. I think his wobbly appearances have been a bigger problem at this point. People don't realize quite how old he is.
Seems to me, Dave, you can overcome the age thing in part if you're talking about something dramatic in terms of policy. In other words, the trick for the winning Democratic presidential candidates was not just having a youthful appearance and kind of being well-suited to talk about tomorrow. They were pivoting the country in some way. Jack Kennedy talking about a new frontier, Barack Obama and that thing called Hope, Clinton being a different kind of Democrat. But Joe Biden right now is not.
How'd those work out?
They all won.
That's not what I mean. The fact is this is an election where you take the third thing. If Biden could get the nomination, mm-hmm. I think he has a better chance than any of the others. That there's a whole set of things could happen between now and then, mistakes he could make. But if the election were held today, he's the Democrat, in my view, that has the best chance to beat Trump.
Right, but now we get back.
Irrespective of age and irrespective of ideas, because the point is, how many Democrats want to beat Trump? And in states like Pennsylvania and in Michigan and Wisconsin, he's still seen as their guy. He doesn't have to promise any of that stuff.
No, well, I think what he promises is a lack of chaos, no drama.
Right. Exactly.
Right, but that's the question. Does the base want another no drama? It seems to me, based on these debates right now, candidates are making a different calculation. They want big stuff. Now, what's curious about this is you see pushback from, you saw some of the debates, you saw some of the, you know, kind of the backbenching moderates like John Delaney and Hickenlooper pushback saying, this is nuts. The Washington Post.
Where did that get them?
The Washington Post pushback against the same concept, saying you can't just be throwing out these ideas that are not going to see the light of day.
He doesn't have the heart of the Democratic Party. But I remember in 2004, John Kerry didn't have the heart of the Democratic Party either, and they decided they wanted to beat Bush, and they nominated Kerry. So the question is, who's going to turn out in these primaries? And the question is, Biden still has the lead among people who say they are. Everybody's going after him, which is proof that he's still the leader.
Right.
And I think if they get him, because he's in the middle, and they have to get him by going after the base, that could cause him all kinds of trouble.
One person who's not going after him is Tulsi Gabbard, the congresswoman from Hawaii, who is 1% polls or whatever, so she can punch up in any direction. And she's decided to punch up in Kamala Harris's direction.
Yeah. I don't think a Democratic candidate in a general election will apologize at all from having been a prosecutor. Mm-hmm. That would seem to be, you know, part of the perfect resume, along with having been a governor of a southern state.
Right.
In the primaries, it's a problem. But it's not going to get Tulsi Gabbard to 3% in the polls.
Right.
No, I agree. But just as in the Republican battle in 2016, where you had a whole bunch of people competing to be the establishment candidate, Tulsi Gabbard looks out there and says, where can I pull some votes? And I think, I agree with Doug, she's not going to do it, but where she thinks she can pull them. So she's going after him. She's not going to get Biden votes.
Right.
I don't think she's going to get votes.
I think
anywhere.
She's going to, you know, the rules are leading to a rapid winnowing of the field well before where it would occur normally.
Yeah.
So a lot of these candidates are going to disappear.
Very good. And besides, she keeps the door open for Biden-Gabbard 2020.
I hadn't thought of that. That's a good point.
It is. Let's talk a bit about the events of the weekend, and I'm not going to ask you too where you stand on the issue of guns in society, but let's talk a bit about the political effect that this has, and that you had many a Democratic presidential candidate wade into this, and many a candidate was not too shy about laying this at the feet of the President of the United States.
Well, no shock about that.
Right.
So gun control is an issue that divides Democrats from Republicans. That Democrats are united in support of gun control, and Republicans are split.
Right.
So there's tension between the NRA and the base and the marginal voters. So
historically, Democratic primary candidates who have made gun control a central theme of their campaign.
Who are you thinking of? Because, I mean, the thing that struck me this weekend...
I can't think of too many.
Weekend,
I'm asking you guys.
Yes. Yeah. So the thing that struck me this weekend is there, after Parkland, there was a surge where it looked like, at least for a while, it might be different than in the past. And then it repeated the usual pattern, which it dies down and gun control disappears as an issue. Mm-hmm. So we have Democratic candidates running on climate change, on inequality, and... Medicare for all, but I don't, you know, all the Democratic candidates are obviously for strengthening gun control, but no one was making it like a centerpiece of their campaign. And,
but I, Dave, I think the reason is because they know it's not going to change. I mean, there were two reasons. Number one, if you go to Montana and check John Tester, he's not going to vote for extreme. They might find something he could vote for.
Right.
But John Tester and the same with the senator from North Dakota, if you look after Parkland, when the bill came up, there were six or seven Democrats that voted with the Republicans. And as long as you have those small, that's one. And two, the second thing is the number of AK-47s already existing in the country. So I just don't know how you, it seems intractable in some
way. No, but you could take the topic, and if you want to nationalize the election on a topic, a Democratic presidential nominee could say, don't just vote for me, vote for a Democratic House and a Democratic Senator, and we will get gun control.
Yeah, I'm not sure that would work, but it does seem to me that a presidential candidate at this point that had owned that issue would have potentially gotten a bump.
I agree with Doug. But the problem is they're all going to say that till you get to the election. But come November, if there's more, and God hopes there isn't, but if there are more, then it could be taken over in that way.
But let's circle back, Dave, to your column and Biden being the king of moderates. So the fact is his election strategy is going to take him into Wisconsin, and it's going to take him into Michigan, and maybe it takes him to Ohio, though, you know, if you look at Ohio right now, maybe... Maybe he doesn't want to spend. Maybe that's probably a foregone conclusion. I don't know. Trump did very well there. It's certainly going to take him into Pennsylvania. Joe from Scranton, PA, but Pennsylvania also includes deer hunter country. So if you're a Democrat wading into those states, you have to talk very carefully about guns. Doug, have you looked at any polling about the gun issue? And is there such a thing as a sensible middle ground for either candidate to take in this time?
Well, I mean, gun control polls really well,
right?
You know. Banning assault weapons, background checks, and so forth.
Right.
You know, how many hunters are you actually going to lose by banning assault weapons?
Right.
You'll lose the NRA. They'll go crazy on that, but they go crazy in background checks.
Right.
The Republicans have painted themselves into a corner where, you know, Trump on yesterday was talking about potentially doing something on background checks, and by this morning that had disappeared.
Right.
So... You know, in general, I'm surprised that Democrats have not pushed that in most places much more than they have.
Right. You're saying focus on the assault weapon, focus on the question of why somebody needs so much firepower, just kind of keep it in that lane.
Well, to most people, it sounds like common sense.
Yes.
Yeah, I don't see, I guess I don't, I agree with that comment, but I don't see... In this Democratic field, they'll all say the same thing. They're looking at this point for something that distinguishes them.
Right.
They're all going to say the same thing. They can't distinguish each other.
But they're all, you know, in favor of doing things
something.
About climate change.
Yeah.
It hasn't worked for Inslee.
Exactly.
But it was a stab at finding something.
Right. But my point is on gun control. Given the last weekend's event, they're all going to be at the same place. You're not going to be able to distinguish one from another by a nanosecond. And the result of that is they're looking for things to distinguish themselves to get into the second round.
Right. I think that's a bad mistake.
To what?
The first thing is within party competitions are a lot less ideological than people think. Mm-hmm. It's just not the case that there's a left-wing lane of voters deciding between Sanders and Warren and a centrist lane deciding between Biden and Harris. There's a lot of fluidity between there because they're all identified as Democrats and they're one measure of
so is that a sign for is Democrats to be in the middle?
Well,
move more to the middle, or
all
what?
Right. So, take Buttigieg. How did this guy emerge? You know, so Yeah. What happened there? And it wasn't a policy thing. I think it was largely his articulateness, authenticity, biography, and so forth.
Right.
And so what you choose to make your campaign about, I think, does have, to some extent, define who you are and can give you an opening, even if you don't disagree with other people.
I agree. But what I'm saying is I don't understand how gun control, how you can distinguish yourself to the left. I can see how you might be a little more moderate.
Everyone will agree with you, but you're the one that's the leader on this
issue. So here's the question, guys.
I just don't see how you get there.
Here's the question. So Pete Buttigieg, he is the Aaron Sorkin candidate in this Democratic field. Aaron Sorkin writes movies about and does TV shows about great, bold Democratic presidents, the West Wing, the American president. All just he's, you know, usually in the plot line is usually a Democrat who kind of finds his spine and he decides, by God, we're going to do something, even though I know it's difficult. So in the American president, I think he goes after gun control as the issue. So Buttigieg is Sorkin-esque in terms of his biography. He's a bright guy. I think he's Ivy League, if I'm not mistaken. He's a veteran.
Harvard graduate.
Exactly. I mean, this is the kind of guy.
McKenzie and the Army.
Yeah, and he's gay. I mean, this is the kind of character Sorkin creates on paper for you. But does he have that Sorkin-esque quality? Is there a candidate, do you think, who's going to have that Sorkin moment where they just decide, by God, I'm just going to say what needs to be said?
He was the only one I thought that had anything like a charismatic run at it, but he's fallen off, and I think if he doesn't do well in Iowa and New Hampshire, he may hang on for a bit, but I don't see him going up.
Yeah, I think the Democratic field is weaker than it looks. Every single one of the candidates that appears to be in contention at the moment has at least something that's problematic.
Let's talk about something that's maybe long-term more problematic for Donald Trump than the gun issue, and that's the economy. You two are entrepreneurs and investors, and if you looked at your stocks today was a bad day on the Dow. It was, 720 points down, I think?
Trump's doing his thing to reduce inequality.
Yes. But seriously, no, when...
That's just by a larger result of the tariffs.
Right, but the economy is the president's safe ground at all times. If there was a bad economy, we'd be talking about who the 46th president is.
Well, Wall Street Journal had a story that he was in the debate.
Right.
That just he was the one that said everybody else on the economic team said don't do it.
Right.
And he did it.
So we're not going to – look, I don't think we're going to have day after day of 720-point downsides on Wall Street, but – if this issue of economic angst does start to creep into the daily conversation, the narrative.
It won't help them.
Right, it doesn't help them. Right. But how does this affect the field?
The Democratic field?
The Democratic field.
You know, they're going to run with whatever economy they've got.
Right.
And if they were having to run today, the economy is not a good issue for Democrats. Mm-hmm. You know, it might change in the next year.
Right.
But it's been surprisingly resilient. The jobs numbers have been good. Mm-hmm. So right now, the Democrats are just praying that Trump doesn't get some discipline and make his reelection about the economy.
Right. But can this group of Democrats, can this party where it is right now, can they run a discipline campaign based largely on the economy and the direction, or is Trump's personality and presence such that at all times it has to be Trump?
Who gets the nomination. Yeah. If it was Warren or Sanders, they're going to run on tremendous changes in the economy. Mm-hmm. They don't like big corporations. They don't like banks, et cetera, et cetera. They don't like the way the economy is run. So if they get it, then that's the way they're going to run.
Right.
And everybody will be to the left of Trump on some issues. But
So the Democrats are going to run on the Trump gave an enormous tax cut to corporations, which polls really badly.
Right.
That you didn't get much of anything, and his billionaire friends got a lot.
Mm-hmm.
That's not going to change whether the economy is good, bad, or indifferent.
Right.
But the fact of the matter is the economy, where unemployment is, where inflation is, where growth is at the moment, it's not a bad issue for Republicans.
Right.
It's a good issue. And if Trump didn't insist on sucking the air out of the room about a random issue every week, I think he could get up to 50% popularity.
Okay, let's talk about another issue, and that's the I word, impeachment. Have you run any numbers lately on impeachment, Doug?
Yeah, we have not found any surge in support for impeachment. It seems relatively stable. So there are more Democratic congressmen coming out in favor of it.
I think a majority of the caucus now favors it.
Yes, and a good majority of Democrats favor impeachment.
Right.
The problem is it's unpopular, not deeply unpopular, but at least marginally unpopular among independents. Mm-hmm. And Republicans hate it. It mobilizes the Republican base.
Independents don't like it either.
Right.
Yeah, I said among independents, it's down by 10 points or so.
Is your sense they don't like it, Dave, because they view it as not warranted, or they view it ultimately as counterproductive, since we're not prognosticators, but it's pretty easy to see that it, even if it were to get through the House, it's going to die in the Senate?
Well, I don't know that voters know that much about it. I can see why House members do it, because their base in their districts is saying impeach them.
Right.
But on that issue, when people say impeach, if you looked at the impeachment of Bill Clinton, it started out, had some popularity among Republicans, but over time it drops off because it takes Congress away from its business of doing something about the problems of the country. Mm-hmm. And then in the end, when Americans figure out it's going nowhere anyway, did all this and now it's going down in the Senate.
Right.
Why did you do that? So I think that's in the long run, that'll be essential. I think the numbers will fall off over time rather than rise. Mm-hmm. They're going to fall.
Yeah, so elections are won in the middle.
Right.
And the middle hates conflict. The base of either party loves it, and what they want is someone to stand up and make a truly stupid and futile gesture, and that's what I would characterize impeachment as.
Yeah. Okay,
for
very
Democrats.
Good. Some sort of hidden political news over the weekend, overshadowed by the shooting. Republican congressmen retiring, specifically four stepping down in Texas.
Yep.
Yep.
A couple of these look like they're on the natural. One in a district in Dallas-Fort Worth. I don't know. Maybe he is wetting his finger and testing the winds. It's a problem for the Republicans because it's going to be a hard seat to hold. We saw a phenomenon in 2018 of Republicans getting out a step ahead of what was to come. Yeah. Is it too early, Dave and Doug, to be looking at these retirements and thinking that there's any kind of wave to be made of?
No, I don't think so. It's a good. It's generally a good indicator. Mm-hmm. They look out at the district. Texas is a state that if black turnout and Latino turnout goes up in Texas, mm-hmm. some of those seats are in trouble, just like down in the Los Angeles areas, those seats shifted in the same way.
Right.
And I did see some very interesting polling on how to get the black vote out. So when they mentioned racism, et cetera, that didn't do much. But what really worked for Latinos and blacks was ineffectiveness. That the issue that caused them most likely to say they'd be more likely to vote was he's ineffective.
Oh, you mean gridlock?
Yeah, the racist thing didn't really seem to.
Reparations doesn't move the needle.
No, reparations doesn't move the needle. Most blacks aren't even in favor of it.
So what's happening in Texas is you have relatively large numbers of suburban voters who have been moving significantly in the Democratic direction. And you have growing minority populations. Mm-hmm. In my opinion, Texas is likely to be a little too much for Democrats to win at a state level in 2020.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But the writing is on the wall that you go a couple more cycles, and Texas is definitely headed towards being a competitive state.
I agree, absolutely.
Yeah, I saw a great line on Twitter the other day. Somebody said that Texas is the new Orange County.
I think that's right. The only caveat I would say to that is, I think so. The number of people who make over $250,000 a year, they voted for Obama, I think, in 2012. And then in 2016, they voted Democrat again. And in 2018, they did. I think that
I doubt that's true in Texas or the South.
But
it's certainly, in the Northeast and California, yes, those groups vote.
But the suburbs in Texas,
where people make money, 250 is way out.
200, whatever it is, 200, pick a number. But the point is, if you're going to increase,
this is Palo Alto thinking.
If you're
going, face
yeah,
here.
He may be right on that. So call it 150. But the point is, if you're going to increase taxes on them.
Mm-hmm.
with Medicare for All and so on and so right. forth, that might affect their ability and willingness to vote Democratic. So right. I think it does matter where Democrats come down on positions, what happens in Texas.
Palo Alto, by the way, the city did a poll last year, Doug, residents making $300,000 consider themselves middle class.
And they're right.
And they are. That's right.
They don't have a house. They're in the trailers. They're in the trailers on El Camino.
Let me run this by you, fellas.
But
if
yes.
If you're better or work and you see the writing on the wall and this presidential thing just ain't going to happen, there is a parachute, and that parachute is the United States Senate. He could easily jump out of the presidential, jump into the Texas race. Now, he'd be running against John Cornyn. And a word of caution here, John Cornyn is not Ted Cruz.
Right.
He is not a lightning rod.
That's why he chose not to run against him in the first place.
Exactly. But if he does decide to run against him now, he has to figure how to win a statewide election without the benefit of a really polarizing guy like Cruz. So how does he do it?
I don't think he does.
Well, first of all, is he at the mercy of who's at the top of the ticket?
Yes.
Yeah, so you count on Trump to generate high turnout among Democratic groups. Younger voters.
But also you hope that maybe Biden and not, let's say, Warren or Sanders.
That's right.
Right.
In Texas, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. All right.
It's, you know, I mean, it's an uphill climb. Cruz is a weaker candidate than Cornyn. Mm-hmm. But, you know, stranger things have happened, and he ran a rather strong race against Cruz, mm-hmm. and he would raise a ton of money yet again.
Let me throw another person at you to think about, and that is a fellow named George Prescott Bush, George P. Bush. Not the 41st president, not the 43rd president, but the son of Jeb Bush. He is now the Texas
Railroad or Land Commissioner.
I think he's Land Commissioner. Yeah. You know, draw the dots, but you can see him running for governor one day, just like his uncle did. But he's a relatively young man. I think he's in his 40s still. But if he's going to run statewide in a changing Texas, he too is going to have to adapt with the time. So get out the crystal ball here and just kind of talk about, as Republicans, you know, continue to evolve in Texas and have to change for the times, what's George P. going to have to do differently than, say, George W. did and what George H.W. did?
Well, that Republican Party is no more.
Right.
And the Texas Republican Party is you know, looks like the National Republican
Party.
Now,
George P. is half Latino. His mother's Latino, so he has an advantage right there.
Well, I lived in Houston for 15 years. Well, Doug's absolutely right. The party changed. When George Bush first won a seat that Bill Archer later took in a suburb of Houston, the Republican Party was essentially a party of Northerners who'd moved to Texas once air conditioning was there.
Right.
And the Bushes contributed money to Planned Parenthood. Mm-hmm. And it really wasn't until the 92 election when Dole pushed him on the right on that they moved to abortion. And W won his campaign by not going to run a nasty campaign, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So I don't know what the Republican Party today doesn't look like it did then. It was kind of free trade. It wasn't anti-immigrant. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what the Republican Party in Texas looks like today for a Bush to run.
Well, here's
what happens here is the parties stick to what they're doing long after the sell-by date.
Right.
So what's likely to happen, I think, in these places that are becoming competitive, where Republicans are going down, is exactly what happened in places, the reverse in the Midwest, where Republicans gain strength. And the local candidates are going to be too closely identified with the national party, and when it swings, they're going to be out of luck for a while.
Like when the Republicans took over in 94.
Well, thanks for mentioning that, Doug, because that tees up very nicely the final question in this podcast. I look back at the 2016 election, and I find it a rather unique election in this regard. To me, it was like watching a football game where two players just run into each other at high speed at midfield, and they stagger off to their respective sidelines with concussions. And they're both sitting there on the sidelines, a little dazed and a little confused, trying to figure out, A, what happened, but also, B, who are we? Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Brady, tell me your name. Who are you?
Yeah.
Exactly.
I think that's pretty good.
But as you watch the Democratic
Party. That strategy worked for you well last time, right?
I can't improve on that. Yeah.
But you watch the Democratic Party right now, in addition to having 20 people on a stage, you're seeing something out of an identity crisis in terms of who are we, what do we believe in, the fact that Barack Obama, a very popular former president, a guy who won two elections, which is not said of a lot of Democratic presidents, the fact that he can be criticized on a stage says something about that this party is going through some odd
on the debates, right now. There was nobody that defended him except Biden. Right. Now, when they had the Labor Council meetings over the weekend, they recognized their mistakes, and when they came in, they were, oh, yeah, he was a great president, et cetera. But I think at a next debate, even if there's eight or nine, they're going to do the same thing.
Right, but you see a public thrashing about, and ultimately it comes down to the question, who are we and what do we believe in? But let's just look at the other side of the coin. Republicans are in no better situation, in some cases maybe worse. First of all, if Donald Trump had dropped the microphone earlier this summer and said, I'm out of here, and just done a James K. Polk and claimed victory on everything he said he would do and walked off, you would have, I would argue right now, the same dynamic as in 2016.
I agree, absolutely.
At least a dozen, maybe 15, maybe 20 people all running, all claiming to be the beating heart and soul.
But they're not going to have that because Trump's going to win.
But in 20, you're going to have it regardless in 2024.
You bet. Yes.
It's an open seat election. So here's the question, guys. Is this something new in American politics? Is this just something cyclical? Is there always kind of a cleansing of the two parties? Or are we seeing something different? Are both parties, in essence, deteriorating because of the extremes they've reached in the past decade?
Well, we certainly are seeing movement of voters across the parties, trends and so forth are changing relative party strength to what we used to call realignment, though it doesn't look like the classic 1896-1932 kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I think it's, on the Democratic side, whenever a relatively moderate candidate, and Hillary Clinton was moderate by Democratic standards, whenever a moderate candidate loses, there's a big chunk of the party that says we lost because we weren't pure enough.
Right.
And that's what you're getting from Sanders and Warren, and they get all the feedback in the debates and so forth to validate that strategy. On the Republican side, you've just seen a wholesale, everything that we knew about the Republican Party has changed.
Right.
Their policies, who's in control, things that, in the spring of 2016, no one would have guessed have happened.
Exactly.
Dave? I agree. So this is not new if I'm old enough to remember this, but...
Well, you're a former Whig, aren't you?
But in 1952, at the Republican convention...
Got me there.
In 1952, the Republican convention, when the Taft people stood on the platform and pointed at Thomas Dewey and said, you led us to defeat twice because you're a moderate, you're not conservative enough. So the difference between, say, as Doug talked about the 1890s, that is that in the 1890s, a lot of dissension, a lot of flipping around, same sort of inequality, jobs, same issues. The difference is the parties had control of who got nominated. The parties today have absolutely lost control of who gets the nomination. And the result is... we now have 20 people for the Democrats, and just like you say in 24, the parties no longer control, and the result of that is this hodgepodge, and I think what it ends up with is you end up with candidates that are unique. Donald Trump, who knows who the Democratic candidate will be this time, but it changes the shape. That many candidates changes the shape of the primaries, who's the winner, how things go along. In 2016, for example, in the YouGov polls that Doug was running, we had a first choice, second choice, third choice. And if the establishment candidates had early in the game been able to decide on a candidate, I believe they could have beaten Trump. But they couldn't. And the Democrats are in the same shape.
Okay. Well, guys, time is up. And guess what? We managed to go 40 minutes without talking about Marianne Williamson.
Well, there was a great line about her.
Yes.
Yeah, and it was a Boston Globe columnist when she said in the second debate, maybe if all these 171 million people have private insurance plans, maybe we ought to think about it. And the Boston Globe columnist says, when you're counting on wisdom from Marianne Williamson, better stand up and listen.
Well, gentlemen, thanks for the podcast. Let's do it again after the next debate. You've been listening to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast on the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States, and in this case, those who want to compete against him next fall. If you've been enjoying Area 45, please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to us, and tell your friends about us. You can find the Hoover Institution online at www.hoover.org, and while you're there, sign up for the Hoover Daily Report, which delivers the best work of Hoover's fellows, including Dave Brady and Doug Rivers, straight to your inbox weekdays. The Hoover Institution has Facebook, Instagram, Twitter feeds. Our Twitter handle is @HooverInst. That's @HooverInst. Dave Brady is not on social media and proud of the fact, but Doug Rivers is. His Twitter handle is @Doug_Rivers. That's @Doug_Rivers. And I mentioned that he also does fine work on the behalf of his YouGov, and YouGov's Twitter handle is @YouGov. That's YouGov. For the Hoover Institution, this is Bill Whalen. We'll be back soon with another installment of Area 45. Until then, take care. Thanks for listening.
For more podcasts from the Hoover Institution, please visit hoover.org or Hoover's channels on iTunes, iTunes U, Stitcher, and SoundCloud. I'm Chris Dauer for the Hoover Institution. Thanks for listening.